This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Something big and complicated is going on and you feel you'll never get your head round it. Me too. But give us 28 minutes and the top experts in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room and we may be able to sort it out. This week, football and the pandemic. How have the shaky finances of our most popular sport been affected by the lockdown? The pandemic may have brought to a head a longer-term crisis in our great national game, a game that enthralls millions and is a significant cultural asset. So this week, I want to know what the state of the football industry now is, how it got there, and what it might take to rescue it. Kick your ball into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. To begin with, we need to understand how the professional game operates. In the old days, when I started watching, the biggest clubs, like Manchester United and Liverpool, would split the income generated by fans buying match tickets with their opponents, many of whom had smaller grounds and therefore less income. There wasn't much money from TV, but what there was divided, unequally of course, between clubs in all four of the professional divisions. Then, it all changed.
It's a fabulous goal!
The FA Premier League.
Lines it up, finds the net.
Live.
In 1992, the top clubs broke away to form the Premier League and then signed a massive deal with Sky TV for the broadcasting rights. The other clubs were out in the cold. Kieran Maguire is an accountancy lecturer at the University of Liverpool and one of the UK's leading experts on football finance.
In 2019, the 20 clubs between them generated just over £5.1 billion. And of that, just over £3 billion came from TV deals. That's a combination of the Premier League's own TV deal that it has with Sky TV and with BT Sport, but also over 100 international deals with overseas broadcasters.
What would you say is the minimum level of funding that a Premier League club gets from television?
It averages 150, but the smaller clubs who don't tend to be on television very much, they'll be getting, you know, around about 100 million compared to 7 million for those clubs in the division below.
Well, that is a gigantic difference. How reliant are Premier League clubs on the money from TV? I suppose what I'm also asking is how important are the actual spectators in generating finance by attending matches and so on?
It does very much vary from club to club. If we take a look at some of the clubs that have recently been in the Premier League, Bournemouth, they generated 88% of their income from broadcast fees. As the clubs become bigger and their attendances increase, so Bournemouth are somewhat constrained by having a ground which has a capacity of only 11,000 people. If you contrast that to the big clubs such as Manchester United at 76,000, Arsenal and Spurs are both in excess of 60, the reliance on broadcasting does decrease a little bit, but fans' contributions are still essential. Manchester United generated over £110 million from match day income in 2019. Spurs and Liverpool and Arsenal generated far more than 80. When you do drop to the smaller clubs, Bournemouth £5 million, Burnley £6 million, they reflect both the nature and the demographics of the fans, but also the fact that these clubs have restricted capacities in terms of where they play their game.
Now, the ones that are over-dependent on television money, how precarious is their position?
There is a danger that if a television broadcaster itself became bankrupt, and this did happen in around about 2005 when there was a company called ITV Digital, it could leave the football clubs themselves in a very dangerous position. And there's also a concern is that if we are looking at one of those clubs which is generating 80% or more of its income from broadcast, if that club gets relegated out of the Premier League, then it loses its rights to all of that money.
Despite having set itself up financially on the basis of that money.
Yes.
Presumably that means getting rid of all these expensive players they've got on contract and paying them off.
Very much so. The average wage in the Premier League is around about £3 million a year. But outside of the Premier League, the TV deal in the division below is only worth around about £7 million a season. So that would pay for just two players.
With both the Premier League and with the other clubs below the Premier League, what has been the impact of the pandemic on those economic structures?
The Premier League clubs are insulated to a certain extent. They have this incredibly lucrative TV deal, but as you drop through the lower leagues, they become more reliant upon matchday income. So by the time we reach League Two, quite often up to half of the total income is as a result of the turnstiles clicking. If you take that money away from those clubs, they become increasingly vulnerable to an issue such as the pandemic. If we can't return to football taking place before an audience, and ultimately, surely, what is professional football if it's not players and fans, then it's difficult to see how clubs can survive financially, and therefore the risk of a significant number of clubs going into administration or worse has got to be a very high probability.
Kieran Maguire. Of course, that's just the men's game. But a big success story over recent years has been the development and rise of the women's game, both at amateur and professional levels. Record numbers are now playing the sport. According to the Football Association, last year more than 2.6 million girls and women were registered players. But as Dr. Alex Calvin, senior lecturer in sports business at Salford University, told me, that's very recent.
In 1921, the FA banned women's football from participating at the grounds of the FA affiliated clubs. And that lasted, you know, from 1921 to 1971. They had medical doctors to support this, citing female fragility. It would affect women's ability to have children. And these gendered stereotypes really influenced the course of the game for women's football. And so 50 years was lost at a time when the trajectory was high for women's football.
Doesn't that just shock a modern sensibility? Today, the top women's league is the Women's Super League, the WSL. What's Alex's assessment of the current condition of the women's game?
TV money is substantially less important in women's football. Commercial deals and sponsorship dwarfs their matchday and broadcast and revenue streams. For example, if you look at Manchester City, which is the top women's club, really, they detailed their annual turnover activity in 2019. And it comprised of commercial activity, which made up nearly 80%. The FA Central Development Fund, which comes primarily from the Football Association, come in at around 10%. Match day was 6% and broadcasting was only 4%. And this breakdown exemplifies the reliance on commercial deals and sponsorship for professional women's football.
Are those commercial deals and sponsorship, does that largely happen through the parent club? In other words, I suppose I'm asking, are women's teams financially dependent on the men's clubs in order to make ends meet?
In a word, yes. Women's football is financially dependent on men's football, and there's two examples where it can be really highly problematic. For example, Notts County was liquidated in 2017-2018 because they didn't have the financial support to support the women's club, and that meant, you know, job losses and relocation for the whole team. And then sometimes if the league club who supports them, for example, Liverpool Football Club at the moment, is not really supporting its women's club, which is representative of Liverpool's stand in world football at the moment. They spent less monies on wages than Manchester City and Arsenal and Chelsea, and they've just been relegated. So there's two examples there which can exemplify the over-reliance of women's football on men's football clubs.
We heard from Kieran that the average wage for a Premier League male footballer is about £3 million a year. What is it for a women's Super League footballer?
The last recorded average was in 2019. It was £27,500 for the average FAWSL player. Now, that's the top league. They are professional footballers.
When the pandemic came along, did the Football Association provide any specific financial support for the Women's Super League?
The Football Association provided no financial support during COVID, and that meant that the Women's Super League season effectively stopped in March, the middle of March. And if we look to places like Germany and America, both FAs in Germany and the USA supported their women's leagues fairly substantially.
Now, presumably, people from the Women's Super League turned round to the Football Association and said, look what the Germans are doing. Why can't you do that? What did they say in return?
They didn't really have the financial support or the medical support to support players through the COVID-19 testing, which was required for the return of football. It resulted in the Premier League supplying, I think, £1 million worth of COVID-19 support, but that didn't start until the 2021 season. So the season stopped, and that was really problematic because it left players in sort of a precarious position because contracts were ending, workplace conditions which were suffering, there's less money, less investment, and that resulted in a high level of mental health concerns for professional women footballers, as we see it at the moment.
Are there additional worries that attach itself to the effect of the pandemic on the women's game that might not apply quite the same way to the men's game?
I've recently done research with Durham University, and we investigated the experience of women's football fans at World Cup 2019. And we interviewed over 100 fans, and I would say over 95% of them said that their one key aspect to what draws them to women's football is that accessibility. You've got players like Megan Rapinoe, who's a world-renowned superstar, not only on the pitch but off it, who gives time to fans post-game. They respond to them on social media. And all of these, you know, connections that fans get with players are distinctly unique to women's football. And there's a concern that if the game is continued to be played behind closed doors because of the COVID-19 pandemic, fans will lose that accessibility with players, and then they'd stop being interested in women's football. And that means that there'll be less players, the gate receipts will be less, and again, that domino effect happens for women's football.
Alex Colvin. So what we've learned is that despite the pandemic, as long as the Premier League has lucrative TV deals in place, the top clubs will probably be okay. But that leaves everyone else, the poorer clubs, the women's sides, the chronically indebted. I wondered if there was a different model that we could learn from. Like, of course, Germany's. Stefan Ersfeld is Germany correspondent of the sports channel ESPN. Stefan, how important is football in German culture?
Well, it's everything in German culture. It's a game across all walks of life, and unlike in the United Kingdom, there are no other sports, for instance. So we have no cricket, we have no rugby, we have no snooker, no darts. It's only football. And if you drive through the country, you will find a football pitch in basically every little village. So it gives the people an identity, the classic us against them, village against village, and if you take it to the next stage, they will reunite and get behind their local big clubs. If you look at the Ruhr Valley, the Ruhrgebiet, which is based in Germany's west, it has the big football clubs, Borussia Dortmund and FC Schalke 04, and if you go there on any given match day, you will see a city made up of the club colours. You'll see flags, you'll see people dressed in the club colours. And if you go on the market to just stock up on your vegetables, the merchants will all talk football.
Now, tell me about the model of the way the German football industry works and how it's different from the British model.
The main difference is the ownership model in German football. The clubs were owned by the fans, the members, for a very, very long time. And football in Germany, it only turned pro in 1963 when the Bundesliga was started. Before that, it was just an amateur sport.
So football only became a professional sport in 1963?
That's it, yeah.
That's very different.
Up until 1989, ownership for a single person was not even allowed. They were run as not-for-profit organizations. It changed in 1989 when the 50-plus-1 rule, which basically says that the fans, the members of the club, have to have the voting majority. But there are models, Bayer Leverkusen, VfL Wolfsburg, company clubs. So Wolfsburg is owned by VW, the big German car manufacturer. They worked their way up the league system. And for them in 1998, this rule was put in place. The 50 was one rule, which had those exemptions for clubs which are owned by or which have been significantly funded financially by just one person, one company for over 20 years.
Stefan, are you saying that what's happened in English football with Russian oligarchs or with sovereign wealth funds from the Middle East owning virtually the entirety of clubs, or American millionaires or British billionaires for that matter, owning the majority of clubs, that is not actually allowed in Germany?
It's not allowed, but there are ways to bypass the rules.
And that ownership model, which is essentially gaming the system, that's not popular with German fans?
Not at all. Fans of every club, they have their say. The ticketing prices, for instance, in Germany, they still have their say. And even if it's, do we get alcohol on the stands? Is there bratwurst available? Whatever.
What's been the impact of the pandemic on German football?
Football has not been hit as hard as other sectors of the entertainment industry, if you want to put football into the entertainment industry, because you still have TV coverage. Other sectors like which rely on live audience, like theater, music, etc., obviously can't stage anything. But clubs here are slowly running into bigger troubles. There are clubs like FC Schalke 04. It's one of the country's biggest clubs. At the early stages of the lockdown, when Bundesliga had not come back, they had been managing their economics badly before, relying on future success. It never materialized. And the pandemic basically laid bare those problems even more. There's going to be a long-term effect. Sponsors will not be able to pay as much money because they will run into economic problems. And Schalke 04 are one of those clubs now desperately trying to sell or offload players to reduce their wage bill. They've got a self-imposed salary cap, reducing their salary to 2.5 million euros for a player per year, whereas they usually paid like 5 to 6 million. You see, football is not as interesting anymore to a TV audience as well. You have the match of the day over in England. We have the Sportschau, which is basically the same. And their audience dropped to an all-time low during the restart of the Bundesliga because of a lack of competitiveness in German football, because of Bayern Munich's dominance over the past 8 seasons in Germany, and no fans.
Stefan Ersfeld with a Blick von den Terrassen, the view from the German terraces. Football is something of a conduit for our national emotions. You may recall in the early days of the pandemic, the health secretary singling super wealthy footballers out as people who should be prepared to sacrifice some of their income. But does it actually matter? Would we really be any worse off if half our clubs closed and their players went to play in China? And if it does matter, is there anything we can do? With me to discuss this are author and sociologist David Goldblatt and Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge University. I want to start by asking both of you what your experiences of consuming football has been during the pandemic. Helen?
I quite surprised myself in the end in enjoying it. For the first 6 weeks or so, I didn't really miss football at all. I was very struck by how little I missed it. And I hated the idea of, you know, empty stadiums. It seems to me that crowds are in the soul of football in some sense. But actually, I think it was much more enjoyable than I expected it to be. And I think that was partly because of the intensity of it, the fact that we got so much football. Although the absurdity of football without crowds was part of my lockdown football experience, the rest of it was much better than I thought once it started again.
David, what about you?
I found it pretty dismal. Even, you know, when the football was great and there was something at stake, I found it rather a hollow experience. And I think it reinforces the fact that football is a vast secular set of rituals, as well as a form of soap opera and public theatre as well. And that made me reflect how mad it is that what is a really important form of ritual and social activity generated by the people who actually go to see it is owned by an unsavoury selection of the global super rich.
Well, we'll come on to some of that in a moment. But it may seem very peculiar that it turns out that a lot of the buzz you get from watching football on television is not from the players, but from the people who are there that you are hearing and not seeing, i.e. the crowd.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the crowd gives meaning and structure to the experience of watching the game. You can sense the kind of crackle of electricity around you as a move builds on the pitch, which then directs your attention to the right place. And everybody else's head and body language is turning, which gives it a further intensity. And you can see that on the television. You can hear it on the radio. You can feel it. I really miss the kind of human contact and idiosyncrasy of being a football game. One of my great pleasures when I go with friends to see Bristol City is to watch the gentleman in front of us whose neck pulsates in different colours of puce and red according to the state of the action on the pitch. And you just can't replace that in a digital format.
Now, it's hard to see that this wouldn't have an impact on whether broadcasters were going to pay quite as much for football or be quite as keen on football if the pandemic continues and if stadia continue to be at either no capacity or much lower capacity. But one of the things which a lot of our listeners are bound to ask themselves if they're not football fans is, well, why does this matter? I mean, one of the trends during the pandemic has been the acceleration of decline of some sectors of the economy. Retailers on the high street, an obvious one, loads closed down near me, for example. Football isn't immune to the impact of the crisis, but does it really matter to, if you like, the kind of the bigger nation?
I think that it does in two different ways. I think that, you know, like football for a long time has been part of this country's national life. It doesn't mean that everybody in the country likes football, quite the contrary. But it has provided, in some sense, a season, a literal season, a structure to the year, structure of time through the year. And it provides a climax at the end of that. And people mark their lives by what happens in football seasons of the clubs that they support. I think also then, in terms of place, particularly where you have a city that has one club, the football is an important part of the economies of those places too. So once you're not having football occurring on a, you know, like a regular basis, like it was for the teams in League One and League Two, because after all, League One and League Two didn't come back. That was a significant economic hit. It's part of the story of the pandemic. The fact that these clubs are in difficulty means that the local economies are in difficulty too.
One of the things that you notice about being a football fan is that younger fans are much less likely to support teams that have any kind of anything to do with their own location. And I'm a Spurs fan, and we get a lot of South Korean fans, tourist fans essentially coming because we have a famous South Korean player, not because they care very much about Spurs itself. So aren't we kind of, I don't know, over-romanticising this?
I mean, that's true if you're thinking about the six global brands at the top of the Premier League. But if you're talking about Bristol Rovers, I can tell you there really aren't too many tourist fans. For many people, that football club is a central source of identity, meaning, personal narrative that binds them to a wider community and that towns and cities embrace. And in England in particular, given how pathetically weak local government and local institutions have been in the last 30 or 40 years, there are very, very few institutions around which these kinds of modern civic identity can be generated, invented, reproduced. So I think that's a fantastically important thing. And it's worth remembering, it may be the case that not everyone likes football, as Helen says, but the numbers are extraordinary. I mean, you know, when the England team plays, the figures are bigger than any royal wedding. So what are we saying? You know, the royal family don't matter because hardly anyone's watching their big events. I mean, that's extraordinary.
It's a good point you make, David. But can we take this on beyond the economic, political and cultural values that we've been talking about, and also look at the health issue, Helen? I mean, millions of people play football as a form of exercise. It's become much harder for people during the lockdown period. And now there's also the kind of danger that, if you like, the ecology of the game is suffering.
You know, I think that this is important. I mean, you know, local club football, amateur football, people just playing it in the park with their mates is a big deal. And I think that, you know, there are quite a lot of stories about the players who grew up, in some sense, I think Wayne Rooney is perhaps the most recent example of it, who really, in some sense, remained street footballers at heart in the way in which they went on to play the game. Football matters in people's lives. It is something that they enjoy doing as well as enjoy watching.
Yeah, I think one of the most telling moments for me of lockdown was a conversation I had with some young folks from Brent about football. And one of them was a regular five-a-side player. I mean, he needed to play football and he couldn't for much of lockdown. I mean, to the point where he and his friends were organising midnight break-ins into five-a-side pitches so that they could play, you know, in Greenford at 1 o'clock in the morning because they were just desperate for it. And I think lockdown has revealed the extraordinary inequality of access to green space and to exercise and sporting facilities that exist in this country.
OK, let's look at ownership. And the first question is, does it actually matter who owns the clubs?
I think absolutely it does matter. I think it matters in different kinds of ways. You know, Qatar's ownership of Paris Saint-Germain and this whole sort of project to turn Paris Saint-Germain in some sense into the, you know, the world's super club, having bought the two most expensive players, in some sense to push, you know, the prices and the wages so far up so that nobody else can compete. And they finally got to a Champions League final, albeit that they then lost. There's no doubt that Qatar and UAE, who own Manchester and City, see this as a form of soft power for their states. And I think that it doesn't do football any good whatsoever to be used by states for political purposes.
David, Hannah says it doesn't do them any good, but it actually doesn't seem to do Paris Saint-Germain any harm. And the fans certainly don't seem to mind as long as the team is successful. I mean,
Fans? I don't think you can say that. I think that's just not true. There are many fans who've got a real issue with it. And it also depends how you measure these things. Are we measuring things in silverware or the authenticity of the experience and control over the meaning? And, you know, sure, if you want to say that all football fans are only interested completely blindly in whether they win or not, well, then that would be the case. But I'm just not sure that that is the nature of football culture.
Well, in that case, I put it to you, should we adopt something much closer to the German system? Should we? Could we?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, football clubs should be socially owned. What is a football club? You know, it's not the owners, it's not the managers, it's not the ground. All of these things come and go. It is a form of collective cultural capital generated over generations by the interaction of the team with the culture of the fans and the wider supporters. And the idea that that should be privately owned seems to me a profound political and moral category mistake. And of course, it could be different. Germany is running very well, where almost every club is at least 50% plus one share socially owned. And we could do the same here. I would like to see a tax, basically, on the turnover of all football clubs, and it would be the same for everybody. And that money should be used to buy the shares from the current owners and pass them to supporters' trusts.
You could argue, Helen, that if you were going to do something like that, you should also use the money to subsidise clubs that were less well off and to subsidise bits of the football system that generated less income.
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of mixed feelings about this. You know, it is possible to have lots of the things that David, or at least it was possible to have lots of the things that David was talking about in terms of what football meant culturally and what it meant in people's individual lives without addressing the ownership question. Now, whether that's still possible and whether some of the excesses, as we now know them, can be taken out of football without that, I don't know. And whether it would be at all possible, really, to, given where we are now, for football in this country at the top level to be as of high quality as it now is, whilst undergoing such a massive change in its ownership, I've also got my doubts about.
Helen Thompson there with David Goldblatt, and my thanks to them and to Kieran Maguire, Alex Colvin and Stefan Ersfeldt. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Jim Frank and Ben Carter. It was mixed by James Beard. And the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including on where we are on Brexit, on Scottish independence,
and on schools and the coronavirus. You can find them all and much, much more on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.